HanselMinutes.com. It's Hansel Minutes, a weekly discussion with web developer and technologist Scott Hanselman, hosted by Carl Franklin. This is Lawrence Ryan announcing show number 86, recorded live Tuesday, October 16, 2007. Support for Hansel Minutes is provided by Telerik RAD Controls, the most comprehensive suite of components for Windows Forms and ASP.NET web applications. Online at www.telerik.com. Support is also provided by .NET Developers Journal, the world's leading .NET developer magazine. Online at www.sys-con.com. In this episode, Scott and Carl talk open source licensing with Act Online President Jonathan Zuck.
Hi, this is Carl Franklin, and you're listening to Hansel Minutes from HanselMinutes.com. I'm here with Scott Hanselman and his guest, Jonathan Zuck, our good buddy. Hey, Jonathan, how are you?
Hey, man, it's great to be here.
Hi, Scott.
How's it going?
Well, what are we talking about? Patent technology? Patent law?
Well, a lot of people have been asking that we do a show on open source licensing, and a lot of people have been emailing me with questions like, I've got some software and I want to put it out there in the world. So then I started to do a little research and realized that this was a way bigger topic than I could handle myself. And then I realized that that our buddy Jonathan here would be the best guy to talk to us about this. So Jonathan, tell us about the organization that you work for and you know what you did before and what you do now.
Sure. Well, most of my professional history is as a software developer, some commercial software, but a lot of custom software built for large government agencies and big companies like American Express and Freddie Mac. The last few years, I've been involved in an organization called the Association for Competitive Technology, which is an IT industry trade association based in Washington and now also in Brussels that kind of fights for the rights of small businesses in the public policy arena. So I've gone from programming to being a defender of programmers.
Okay. So, gosh, why? What caused you to like get into the whole DC thing? I assume you have to put on a suit and go to Capitol Hill?
I know, it's kind of funny. I've been in Washington since graduate school in 1987 and regarded for many years the White House and the Capitol building as just part of the Smithsonian, right? You know, the Capitol building was this place with a dome that if you stood on opposite ends of it, you could hear each other whisper. And if you got a special pass, you could go see, you know, statesmen debating about stuff. And none of it had any relevance to our day-to-day lives, especially, you know, entrepreneurs in the tech field. But increasingly, the decisions that are being made in Washington and Brussels and around the world are starting to have a real impact on businesses, large and small, in the technology sector. And so I thought it was time to be a part of having an impact beyond just my own business.
Now, you started teaching the lawmakers about things that they clearly knew nothing about especially when Microsoft was in hot water the first time, and they would get up in front of juries and try to be technical, and they really had no idea what they were saying. So
if you think about it, laws are mostly made by people that are having to deal with all kinds of different issues. So, you know, they've just had a meeting about labor statistics, and then suddenly you come in to talk to them about some sort of technology policy. It's enough to make your head explode, I'm sure. Yeah. I mean, for the most part, we're talking about people that have just about managed agricultural policy. So to talk about, you know, web browsers and service-based architectures and the implications for cross-border commerce, for example, it's a tall order to get them to understand it. So my gift of persistence and metaphor, I suppose, has served me well in communicating with people whose day-to-day jobs don't involve technology.
Just out of curiosity, are there any congressmen or U.S. congressmen or U.S. senators that are technical or like maybe, you know, closet geeks that we don't know about? Have you met any that are like, that you surprised you and immediately start talking tech and you realize that this guy's running his own home server and he's got his whole house wired?
Isn't David Rockefeller kind of a geek?
Yeah, there's certainly a number of hidden geeks on Capitol Hill. There's no question. I mean, there are entrepreneurs who, like me, have built businesses and then have decided to go on to try and impact something beyond their own customer base. I mean, Daryl Issa, for example, is the inventor of the Viper car alarm system, right? And And so he comes to the Congress with a real technology and engineering background and gets these issues very quickly. And then there's other people that just sort of naturally think along those lines and are just early adopters of technology and are excited by the benefits it can bring to, you know, their websites and their campaigns, et cetera. And that early involvement, mainly by younger members of Congress, makes them a little bit more technology savvy up front.
So how much are you involved in open source licensing and as it relates to companies deciding to open source something or possibly defending themselves against an open source thing? I mean, it's kind of a broad question, but a lot of people want to get software out there, but at the same time, right, they want to kind of put their thumb on it like a chess piece just in case they want to do something with it in the future.
I mean, I think that's probably a good categorization of the place that a lot of entrepreneurs find themselves. You know, a lot of the work of ACT has to do with public policy and the laws surrounding the technology industry. But there's a whole different side, if you will, to the industry, which is sort of how it exists with itself and the kinds of agreements and contracts that exist between industry partners and between innovators and their customers. And it's certainly nothing new. I mean, all three of us are old enough to have created shareware, for example, which was another type of license for your software. I mean, I remember getting a game once, and he created a license he called Smileware, where all he asked in return for his software was that you send him a postcard saying how much you enjoyed it. So, I mean, a lot of creative licensing is certainly not a new concept.
I never even got a postcard for my shareware.
Shareware, I think different people had mixed success with that. In some ways, I think shareware, the degree to which shareware enjoyed some success back in the late 80s and early 90s, was actually a function of the work done by organizations like the Business Software Alliance and the Software Publishers Association to do sort of like software audits inside of large organizations. I remember I created a little utility for printing your screen to LaserJet and Epson printers. It was sort of like graphics.com, but with better printer support. And I put it up there and I said, well, if you like it, send $5, right? And 10,000 people downloaded it. And I would say that maybe 15 people sent $5, right? And it made me wonder that maybe I should have put this software out under a different license. But what saved the day was that Merrill Lynch called. And Merrill Lynch had probably just been through or had a colleague just be through a big time software audit. And so their question was, we want to pay for this and we want to know what it costs for an organization wide license. So I would just throw out a number like, well, $5,000. And they'd be like, okay. And I'm like, per department, I meant, you know, and so you, you end up with those kinds of negotiations, that are a function of working in a world in which large businesses are creating legal precedents, that we all benefit from. Cause otherwise the shareware model had some critical flaws. I think today with the sort of resurgence and formalization, if you will, of a concept of free and open source software and how this religion has sort of commingled with some industry players that have seen benefits to investing has created a lot more visibility for alternatives to commercial licensing, right? So those alternatives have always existed, but I think now they're getting a lot more attention. And so people are looking at trying to figure out how they can ride this wave, how they can gain the benefits of a lot of people looking at their source code, for example, or the wide distribution associated with making their software free and maybe gaining their benefits elsewhere. And so I think that's why Scott's getting more and more of these questions about, well, if I want to put out a piece of software, what sort of license should I use?
It seems like there's a couple of different categories of this kind of thing. I mean, there's the I want credit for having done it, but as far as other than that, you know, just keep my name in the source somewhere so that people know I did it. And then there's the this is for reference, right? Like the new reference license that Microsoft's got where you can look at the code, but you really can't do anything with it other than use it as a learning tool. What are some of the major categories of open source licensing software? Open source licenses, rather, because there's hundreds of different licenses, right?
Yeah, sure. There's an organization, in fact, called the Open Source Initiative, or OSI, that has attempted to compile all of these different open source licenses, and they've attempted to bless licenses that can call themselves open source. And in some respects, I think that's far less important to the typical entrepreneur or innovator that their license be blessed by some organization than that it meet their needs, right? And everybody has sort of individual needs for a particular software license that they might offer their product under. If you think about software licensing, it's kind of a continuum. You know, on the one side is the public domain license that basically says that I want to make this software available to the world, to the community, and I don't want anything in return, and I don't want any responsibility for it either, but it's just free to use any way that you want to use it. And on the other side of the continuum is a typical commercial software license that could be very specific about how the software can be used and under the conditions of which they have to give the software back, etc. There's even been provisions in end-user license agreements that specify that the software can't be used for illegal activity, for example. So there's on a commercial license, on a full-blown commercial license, there can be an awful lot of requirements and specifications as to how that software can be used. And then along that continuum, there's a lot of different choices and categories of licenses that have to do with what kind of limits you want to place on the use of the software or what kind of rights you want to retain for the software that you've created. So if you think, starting again from the left, the next software, you know, the little bit more restrictive license is the Berkeley software license that you hear from a lot of people, the so-called BSD license. And that license has mostly to do with releasing your software out for any purpose, but you really want limited liability associated with the use of that software. So what you're saying to people is, hey, you can use this software any way you like, but I take no responsibility for the software or how you use it. Don't call me, right? So if you build this software that's for cruise missile guidance systems and it knocks off somebody's grandma's house, it's not your responsibility, right? It's got to be the responsibility of the person who made use of the software.
And just by virtue of the fact that you put that license in the, you know, in a license.txt file, but by them using it, they have kind of implicitly accepted that license?
That's exactly right. By them using that source code, you're saying if you don't agree to assume full liability for the use of this source code, then you're not allowed to use it. So in other words, if they don't agree to that level of liability, then they are not allowed to use that source code from you. And so the next license over, and the one that's gotten a lot of publicity in recent years, is something called the General Public License, and or GPL. And that came out of the Free Software Foundation. And that license has a particular purpose, which is to, in a somewhat viral fashion, expand the base of freely available software. So while that software is freely available for use, there's some restrictions that have to do with, once you use this software, what you have to do with your modifications to the software, that you have to give back your modifications back into this sort of communal system of software that's built up around this license. So that particular license is one that very heavily makes use of your copyright, that says that this is still my software, I still own the rights to it, and that I'm giving you the ability to use this source code in your own products, but with the proviso that you will give back any modifications you make to the software so that I can improve my software, the community can make use of those modifications. So it's a license that is designed by a community as opposed to an individual vendor. And I think that's one of the things that distinguishes it. It's a license that's designed to build up the resources of a community rather than specifically address the interests of a software builder.
You know, initially that sounds like such a great idea, but one of the things that we got in trouble with, because our lawyers didn't understand it, maybe you can answer this, is that let's say that I'm using a testing framework that's GPL'd, and I'm testing software that I don't want GPL'd, but they've become linked, right? And this is where we get into that technical versus legal. I've gone and said, using the .NET-ism, add reference, and now, you know, in memory these things are linked, but on disk they're not. You know, has that virus, quote unquote, spread into my software? Do I have to now give away the thing that I'm testing?
Right. And I think that that's the, I think that's one of the issues. And in fact, that is the reason that they developed something called the Lightweight GPL or LGPL, was to facilitate the coexistence of GPL and non-GPL software if that software wasn't specifically integrated. In other words, if you redistribute a piece of software in which you have incorporated actual source code from a GPL, code base, then your code essentially becomes GPL source code. But mm-hmm. you do have the ability to kind of mix things at a DLL level and allow to create software that interacts with GPL software without taking on the viral nature of that license.
So that limited could also mean library.
That's right.
Okay.
The library GPL, exactly. And then the other license that's becoming popular in the commercial space is a so-called reference or shared source license, which is designed by commercial software vendors to get at some of the advantages that are enjoyed by the availability of source code without really releasing any of their rights. In other mm-hmm. words, under a license like that, you have the ability to look at source code. You have the ability to incorporate the source code into your debugging process, for example. Mm-hmm. You're allowed to use the source code to create software that better interoperates with this existing software, but you haven't been granted any rights to modify the source code or to redistribute it under your own name, for example, the way that you can under a GPL license. So that's still really largely a commercial software license, but the source has been opened up in such a way that it's made available for your viewing and to be helpful to you, but it's not designed to allow you to create a competitive product and mm-hmm. and redistribute that under your own name. And so as you start further down that continuum, it becomes more about your own intellectual property and your ability to protect how that software gets used downstream. And that's what you're getting into when you get into a real commercial license.
Now, one of the licenses that you haven't mentioned yet that I see more and more, and perhaps it's more of a media license, but I'm seeing it in source as well, this is Creative Commons.
That's exactly right. Lawrence Lessig saw a lot of the same phenomena, a lot of the questions that you're asking or that you're saying people are asking you about how they should release their software have been asked in the creative community for a long time. In other words, if I'm an author or a musician and I want to make my music available for nonprofits, for example, for free, but I want for people that are making money off the music to have to pay me, or I want to make my music available to anybody to listen to, but I don't want them to be able to modify it and make it into their own music, etc. So there's all these different sort of permutations of what people would like to do to more creatively get their own content out to the public. And, historically, you've had to go through publishers, either music publishers or book publishers. And so Lawrence Lessig created something called the Creative Commons, which is really a set of licenses designed for artists to kind of specify in some detail, well, this is okay, but this isn't, and this is okay, but this isn't. So that rather than having to just go with one specific type of commercial CD-based license, you again have a continuum of artistic licenses that are made available to you in relatively layman's terms, so that as an mm-hmm. artist, you can put out content in a number of different ways.
I actually license the content of my blog under the, I think it's the Creative Commons Attribution License, and then the sample code kind of, I assume, that's a good question, I assume falls within that when I paste code that I, samples and snippets within that. The entire blog and all of the things found within are under that attribution license, which says, use it, not for commercial things, but, link back to me, make sure that people know that it came from me.
I think that's exactly right. I mean, those licenses allow you to specify how you want things that you've written to be attributed to you and allow you with some fine detail, basically, to say what's okay and what isn't okay. And it's meant to be empowering for artists as opposed to them just selling their rights over to a publisher and then having them define how that content gets out to the market. I think Creative Commons has been a really exciting project.
Now, how much are these just things that people, kind of stamp on a project and it makes them feel good versus something that they could really have backing them up in court? I mean, have these things been challenged?
Well, I mean, there are challenges that take place over licenses all the time. I mean, for example, the Free Software Foundation has had legal action against TiVo, for example. Because what triggers the viral nature of the GPL is the notion of redistribution of source code. In other words, if I get a copy of OpenOffice and I modify it to create the world's best word processing program that I'm going to use inside of a big bank that I work for example, I don't have to give anything to anybody. Where that viral license comes into play is if I then turn around and decide that I'm going to ship the, you know, I'm trying to come up with a name that isn't a real bank, you know, the lampshade bank, you know, office suite, then at that moment, that distribution triggers that viral requirement that I then give all those modifications back into the public. And so, you know, TiVo had an interesting problem where they weren't distributing a version of Linux as a commercial product, but they were distributing a product that used a modified version of Linux. And there was certainly a legal battle surrounding whether that represented redistribution, et cetera. So there are fights that take place in the marketplace that help to define the legality and enforceability of these agreements. But for the most part, they're quite enforceable. If you accept content or software under a particular license, then you're bound by that license.
How are these things different than patent disputes? I know Vonage is in trouble right now, I think, with Sprint or Verizon, one of those guys, maybe both. What is the difference between a patent dispute and a licensing dispute?
Well, a license is actually a contract between two parties. In other words, you're basically, I'm putting software out under a particular license, and as a customer, you're saying that I'll use I'm going to use this software, and in so doing, I'm inferring that you can this license will be enforceable, right? So it represents a kind of contract. A patent is something a little bit more complex, and that's basically a government sanction or a government-sanctioned monopoly over a particular technology that says that I've registered this invention, I was the first to invent this, and nobody else can do anything exactly like this. And that's a little more complicated because then you sort of have to go back through the government to see whether or not that gets enforced. It's not something that you sort of enforce directly the way that you do with a license or a contract.
So then if I put a license on something, if I come up with a new algorithm, I license it, Creative Commons, a bunch of people use it, and then a year later we find out that it was patented 10 years before, but a bunch of people found it from me and used my license, then what?
Well, it's complicated because you're actually licensing something different than they were patenting. They're ultimately patenting the underlying algorithm, the ultimate the idea or invention behind the process that you have in fact implemented via source code. Your license was for your implementation. In other words, if I read in a scientific journal about a new quicksort process or something like that, we can both implement it, in our own code, provided we're not violating a patent, and we could both license our implementations of that invention. So I would have this licensing revenue associated with my implementation, and a patent holder, if you really did violate a patent, could then come to you and say, well, you have your license revenue, but you should have been paying me royalties for my invention as part of the product that you were licensing. And that's exactly what happened to Microsoft in the context of Aeolus in their browser and Alcatel with the MP3 format. So there are issues whereby it's not a question of your license being superseded by a patent, but that any revenues you generate through that license could be subject to some kind of royalty payments to the inventor of the underlying invention that you implemented via source code.
Jonathan, I'm always interested in people's thoughts on pricing because, prices is sort of the lifeblood of any economy, and it's sort of everything in money and everything in the economy comes down to pricing. And I find it very difficult as a developer of software, when I've tried to do this, to figure out what software is worth. How do I price it? I mean, it all comes down to the price in the license, within the confines of the license. But, I'll often find that people will price software according to how long it took them to develop it or, what they think it's worth in terms of the actual bits. But, it's very difficult to get your mind around the fact that what it's worth is what people will pay for it.
Oh, that's exactly right. I mean, often we ask the question, is this a prescription or a vitamin? In other words, do I need this to live? Or would it just be nice if I had one of these every day? And those kinds of answers are going to dramatically affect your pricing strategy for your product. And very often there's no connection between the level of effort that you put into the development of the product and the value of that product in the marketplace. And to come up with that price, you're going to have to do market research. You're going to have to do some focus groups and get an understanding from people what the criticality of that software might be to their business. And the more critical it is, the more you're going to be able to charge. I think that's really going to just be a function of market research. And you can't base that at all on spitballing based on your level of effort.
Well, putting that into the context of open source licensing, it seems like there's a lot of software that people simply aren't willing to pay for. And, to Carl's point, pricing is difficult. And oftentimes, if it's worth $1 or $2, or if it's a couple of hundred lines of something, or if it's, an MP3 encoder, but it's not something that's a 1995 build a company around it kind of a thing, I'm just going to throw it out there. And I'm wondering kind of if I've just got a bunch of software and I just like to put it out there for the people. But if in the future something comes along where people start making piles of money off it, I'd like them to give me a call. Basically, it's like, I don't want to build a business around this, but if you do, call me. I mean, what license is appropriate for that? Seems like one could throw as much stuff out there as possible and let someone else take the risk.
Well, and obviously, that's a kind of idyllic, situation.
Yeah.
You do in most instances retain the rights to the things that you do. And so there are a number of software companies. If you remember way back, the company that, built the software Procom, which
oh,
is
yeah.
communication
Procom
software, was in both the commercial, business space and the shareware business space. And they just had a previous version, available as shareware and the current version available as commercial software, for example. So they were able through their shareware model to gain an understanding of what was needed in the marketplace, get recommendations for new features, etc., and build up a customer base of people that wanted to use that software. But then if you wanted the most recent version, you had to pay for it. So that was one way that you could, deal with that dichotomy. In sort of modern day, there's a company called MySQL that, have a SQL database engine, and they do exactly the same thing. They have both a GPL-based version of their product and a commercial version of their product, and because they own the copyright, they're able to distribute the same software under two different licenses. And so you can begin to experiment with the licensing in such a way that you're doing the market research. You're building a community of people that are going to support your software downstream, but when it comes to trying to sell the stuff into American Express, you can relieve them of the burdens of a GPL-based license by selling it to them commercially.
I never understood that, and I think you were just about to touch on that, which is how can somebody give away software on one hand and then charge for the same thing on the other hand, and how does that possibly work?
Right. What license would I pick to have the Scott Program Community Edition that people have sourced to and the Scott Commercial Edition that I can then sell that's better?
Right. I mean, we know Rob Howard does that with Community Server, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they have two versions of that product as well. It fundamentally has to do with what kind of license your customer wants to be under.
Mm-hmm.
Remember that the GPL has a lot of restrictions and a lot of kind of dangers associated with it that you might not want to deal with. I might want to use this software commercially, for example. I might want to distribute a product that makes use of this software, and I don't want to have to worry about whether or not I'm giving back the right thing, etc. So just charge me a license fee and give me a commercial software license. And in that context, a company like MySQL can go to SAP, for example, and say, okay, well, you want to use the MySQL engine behind your commercial tools, you can do it. Here's the royalty fees you pay for it, and you don't have to worry at all about the GPL.
I see.
Now, there's other people out there that are using the GPL version of MySQL, but SAP doesn't care about that.
It really comes down to, your tolerance for being illegal, right? I mean, a small mom-and-pop company with one guy who doesn't have anything to lose can, violate a GPL agreement by making copies or whatever, doing whatever it is with it. But a big corporation who's going to distribute that to every desktop, if that's not covered in the free license, they're now vulnerable legally. I guess that's really what it comes down to, isn't it?
Well, partly. I mean, under the GPL, you can buy one copy of a piece of software and give it to everybody in your organization, and that falls within the license. It's only the point at which you sort of then republish it under your own name or put out some piece of that as your own product that you trigger this reciprocity portion of the license that says that, okay, well, you've done a redistribution. Now, whatever it is you're redistributing under your name, you have to give back to everybody to redistribute it under their names, right?
Okay.
So, I mean, in some measure, you have that issue. But if I'm building a commercial software package that I'm selling to people, then it becomes questionable about whether or not, maybe I've modified the source code slightly to meet my needs, to interoperate better, et cetera, and I don't want to make that available to the community. So, if I'm SAP, I just go to MySQL and say, please give me a commercial software license where I don't have to worry about those things. And the fact that other people have the source code to your database doesn't matter to me as somebody who's really just using the database to power my ERP application.
Right. Putting this in the context of something that I know, like working on DOS Blog, the company that Clemens Vaster's, the father of DOS Blog's, Newtelligence, released Newtelligence DOS Blog Community Edition, and that's the one that we work on, and that's the DOS Blog that everyone knows, and I think it's BSD. But they reserve the right to potentially improve it, add some features, not release that source, and they can sell it under a commercial license. And they made us kind of agree to have Newtelligence in the name of the product for the Community Edition.
Jonathan, can you give us an example of a software license that didn't work? Like somebody chose the wrong model and it hurt them?
Well, I mean, there's a lot of ways to interpret that question, right? I mean, when Netscape started failing in the browser market, they donated their browser over to a nonprofit, their source code over to a nonprofit to build it out as an open source product. And that was called Mozilla. And for, many, many years, that project sort of like collapsed under its own weight and wasn't very effective. But the very nature of that kind of open source license is that ultimately another team were able to take that core technology and develop it into Firefox, which has become a really relevant competitor to Explorer and Safari in the marketplace. And so, it wasn't right for the Mozilla project in some ways, but it really worked out well for Firefox. You'll see situations where there's commercial software that will be kind of donated into the open source arena because it didn't work as a commercial product. And so it helps generate goodwill and a source code base that allows others maybe to pick up the ball or a community of people to pick up the ball and carry it from there.
I'm thinking about those companies that had software that you pay once for in 1 week and then the next week they're charging a monthly fee for. And which is supposedly great for them, but why would your user base want to go from paying once to paying monthly, or else it stops working? That software as a service model sort of works for some things and not for others, I think.
Right. And I guess I don't know of a specific example where something has worked or not worked, but you always have, again, a continuum of possibilities. I mean, do you want to just get automatic updates for a year, or do you want to buy a piece of software that only enables you to get one update and then you have to buy an upgrade, for example? I mean, it sort of depends on what your business model is and the degree to which the vendor is capable of being flexible. Then as a customer, you can kind of decide what sort of a purchase model you want to have for the maintenance of that software going forward, right? It's mostly about new versions rather than just sort of crippling the one that you have.
And it's the factor we haven't talked about, which is competition, that which affects pricing, which affects your model, which affects everything. If you have a competitor out there that has a particular license that, is more lenient to the customer and less commercial, you'll have a tough time trying to sell that software under a commercial license.
That's the theory, right? But then look at how many people go out and buy Evian water, right? I mean, that's the commercial software version of the stuff that comes out of the tap at your house. And so the degree to which you're able to build something that people feel they can rely on more, that's going to be better supported, that has a better community of people that kind of back up that software, that know it, that can implement it on a consultancy basis. There's a lot of factors that go into the value of your product beyond just the price and features of that product. And so I think it's a mistake to believe that you can't compete with open source software with commercial software, because it happens all the time.
Well, this sounds like a pretty good place to stop. And just as we end here, what was the name of the website where people can go up and get a list of the different open source licenses so that our listeners could potentially educate themselves and make the right decision about how they want to release the software that they might have in their garage?
Right. I mean, the Open Source Initiative, or OSI, is the organization that maintains all these open source licenses and kind of blesses them as open source. But let's, you know, keep in mind that it could be that you don't want to do an open source license, but that you instead want to make your source code available under a commercial license in a type of reference oriented license, for example.
And can people get involved with your organization?
They sure can. I mean, we're a trade association and we work on issues related to public policy. One place I guess I'd like to direct people right now to get answers of these kinds of questions and just talking about the business side of their enterprise is something called the Innovators Network. So if they go to www.innovators-network.org, you'll see a lot of resources and white papers and webinars on the business side of your business. And I think a lot of entrepreneurs have, you know, all they need in terms of keeping up with the technology side of their business. And this site is about how to form partnerships, how to identify and protect your intellectual property, how to do due diligence on your business, etc. So Innovators Network, I think, is worth checking out.
Great. We'll be sure to include a link to the Innovators Network on both the Hanselmanet site and on the on my blog. Thanks a lot for taking so much time out of your day to talk to Carl and I, Jonathan. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
And we'll see you next week on Hanselmanet.